Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm thrilled to be with all of you here today. I have a great show planned. My guest today is Earl Fultz. He is the CEO of a new startup company called Harissa, which is getting lots of attention, not only the story around Earl Fultz's establishment, but the love story surrounding this food venture. So I can't wait to invite him on in a little bit and share his journey with all of you. But first, I want to talk about some things going on in the news, some things going on in around the city, and share a little bit of what's going on in my life. First, I think I just want to start with how my day started today. I've been caring for my cousin for the last 4 months, who has terminal lung cancer that has spread to most of her body. And she's been living with me, and this morning the pain just got so bad we ended up in the emergency with an ambulance. And it was, you know, really, really difficult. It was difficult, and, you know, we're working on managing the pain, and, you know, I've just been watching the development and the downward spiral of someone's life who was just so vibrant, and it's difficult. And how I wish, you know, we had caught it earlier and we could have worked on some alternative modalities to try to catch the thing before it took her, but it didn't happen that way. So, you know I talk to all of us all the time about what we eat and what we put in our bodies and the environmental toxins that are all around us. And I'm constantly trying to share awareness about things that we can do policy-wise, lobbying-wise, to try to make our world a better place, both environmentally and to push back for really good food and healthier food. And, you know, I know President Obama in his last speech said, you know, he's giving it to Joe Biden to come up with a cure for cancer. But we have to get away from a society just thinks we take a pill to fix everything. That's the kind of the world we're living in. And, you know, I know, you know, on the front page of the New York Times, they were talking about, you know, the methane gas from cows. And, you know, they're looking for a pill now to reduce the methane gas emissions in cows. And, you know, everything, the way we think, is just like, you have a problem, let's take a pill to fix it, rather than trying to back up a little bit and look at where's the problem coming from. You know, okay, you know, cows release methane from both ends. What can we do about it? Reduce the number of cows, cut back on our meat intake, feed them food that they're supposed to eat, not grain that they're not supposed to eat, so that their bodies can digest the food better, so that they're not belching and farting so much. I mean, there's things that we can do, but we just don't think like that. We always think of, you know, you have a problem, let's take something to fix it, as opposed to trying to fix the problem. So anyway, just a little food for thought in this Thursday in January. Lots of great things going on in and around the city. We still have a few weeks left of Restaurant Week. As you know, Restaurant Week is no longer a week. It's many weeks, but I guess we have 1 week left. It ends February 5th. But it's an opportunity to check out some restaurants that you otherwise might not be able to go to. There's both lunches and dinners being offered, price-fixed meals. So go on to the New York City Restaurant Week website and find out if the restaurant you've been dying to try is on there and check it out. Tonight, there is a great gathering that's being hosted by Food and Water Watch and sponsored by lots of other organizations, Sierra Club, Slow Food North Shore, IE Green. It's a information session to learn about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how it would affect Long Island, New York, and why we really need to all kind of band together and try to derail this before Congress votes it into law. This partnership is, I've been talking about it for a long time now, you know, before when it was being negotiated behind closed doors, and now that it's been, it's come forward, and it's, you know, the paper is out and people can see it, it's even worse than people thought. And it's just so pro-corporation and business, and so little regard. I don't think they talk about sustainability once in the whole partnership. It's really just about trying to find the cheapest labor, the cheapest food, the cheapest everything, and it's not really good for anybody except for big business. And it's really scary that our politicians, the people that we vote in, you know, once again, just care so much more about the bottom line and profit than they do about the health and well-being of their constituents. So if you can make it, this is being hosted at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at Shelter Rock. There was one this week also in Jackson Heights. But if you go to the Food and Water Watch website, you can find out if they're offering this in other areas where you might be. But try to find out about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and why it's so bad, and sign those petitions and do what you can and let our congressmen know that we really don't want this to be passed. On January 31st, on Sunday, there's a New York Chili Fest that's going to take place at the Chelsea Market. This is an annual event. This year, it is sponsoring or supporting Wellness in the Schools. So it's a fundraiser for Wellness in the Schools, which is a great organization. Bill Talapan was one of the founders of this organization. And it is an organization really bringing awareness for good nutrition and good exercise into the schools. Really great organization. It's from 7 to 9 on Sunday, January 31st. If you can make it, you'll be supporting a great thing. February 2nd, Slow Food International is having a slow food wine tour. I've been telling you guys about it for a while, but I really didn't have any of the details. Finally, I know where it is. I was saying it was February 3rd, but it's actually February 2nd. It's taking place at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in the Empire Room, and that's at 301 Park Avenue from 6 to 8:30. And it's going to be an opportunity to check out lots of different wines. A lot of them will be Italian wines, if not all Italian wines. But if you go, you also will get a book of the slow wine tour or the slow food wine guide. So it's really, you know, about raising wine in a sustainable way where the grapes are not sprayed and they're not all these added sulfites. So it's really a nice opportunity to check out some really nice wine. So if you can make it, that's wonderful. February 8th through 9th is the Soil and Nutrition Conference that I've been telling you about. This one is at Stockbridge, Mass. But if you go to their website, the BioNutrient website, you can find out if they're having conferences in your area. But these guys are really, really full of very, very good information. I took a workshop with them up at Stone Barns and learned a lot about soil nutrition, and it really helped me in my garden. So you can check that out. February 9th is the Food Almanac at the Brooklyn Winery. That's sponsored by Slow Food New York City, and that is from 6 to 9:30. It's $45 for members, $55 for others. Definitely worth checking out. February 13th is the Long Island Regional Seed Consortium. Great opportunity to do it's a seed swap, I'm sorry, and it's a great opportunity to get local seeds. And for those of us that have been growing, we know that growing vegetables that have been grown in this region before is really ideal. You know, the seeds and the soil adapt to each other, and you can grow the best vegetables if you actually get local seeds. So check that out. Lots of stuff is going on about seafood. Slow Food has gotten behind the seafood push to raise awareness about local, sustainable seafood, how it's caught, and there's an opportunity on February 16th through 18th. There's going to be a big local seafood summit down in Norfolk, Virginia. And there's also one, where's the other one? There's another one. Huh, I'm not seeing it right here. Oh, here we go. March 10th through 13th, the Slowfish New Orleans. But both of these opportunities are, you know, are opportunities to get together with other people that are working towards a more sustainable local seafood system. And we need everybody to be aware of it. I know we've all heard about buying wild fish about as opposed to farm-raised fish. Really great to do that. I encourage everybody when you go to a restaurant to ask for wild fish. Let the restaurateurs know that we care about sourcing sustainably raised or sustainably caught fish. And do the same thing if you're going to eat meat. Find out where it comes from. Find out how it's raised. Find out where it's raised. Become informed. It's really the best thing we can all do to take back our food system. March 13th is the Just Food Conference, always a great information packed seminar. Over 700 organizers are involved, community leaders, CSA members, local food advocates. It's really a great day. It's taking place up at Teachers College, Columbia University, March 13th. You can buy tickets online, and it's really, really a worthwhile event. I have lots more on my website, so check it out at iegreen.com. But right now, I want to share a recipe with you so that I can invite my guest on. This week's recipe is the best gluten-free vegan carrot cake I think I've ever had. Of course, I made it, but it's taken many many rounds to actually get it to this point, and it's really great. It's as good as any carrot cake I've ever had, and it's made with gluten-free flour, and it's made without any eggs or dairy. So you're going to use 3 cups of gluten-free flour. I use Pamela's bread mix flour. I just like the mixture of it. She also has a baking concoction, but that one has eggs in it. So if you are vegan, this is the one to use. 3 cups of gluten-free. This is Pamela's bread mix flour. 1 cup of ground oat flour. So I basically take some really good gluten-free oats that I buy, and I grind them up to make a coarse flour, and I add a cup of that. 1 cup of ground coconut. Again, I buy shredded coconut, and I just pulse it a little bit in the Cuisinart so that it's a little bit more of the texture of sugar. A lot of, you know, making this cake really work is getting the texture right so it's not too dense, so that it has enough levity to it. 4 teaspoons of cinnamon, 1 tablespoon of baking soda, 1 tablespoon of baking powder, 1 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1 cup of raisins, 2 cups of walnuts, 1/2 cup of potato starch, 1 1/2 teaspoon nutmeg. Now, potato starch, just to back up a minute, that's used often in gluten-free baking. It just helps hold everything together. And that was one of the new ingredients that I used this time, and it definitely made the texture better. 1 cup of puffed millet or rice, and that I put into the mixture, again, to give it some air so it's not so dense. So a cup of puffed millet, organic millet or rice cereal. 4 cups of shredded carrots, 2 cups of applesauce, 1 1/2 cups of maple syrup, 4 tablespoons flaxseed that I dissolve in 1/4 cup of warm water, 6 teaspoons of vanilla, 1 1/2 cups of oil, 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, and 1 can of organic crushed pineapple that I drained. And you're just going to mix the first 12 ingredients into a bowl and just mix it up really well. Then you mix the remaining ingredients, except for the carrots, into another bowl. Then you mix the wet with the dry, and you bake it at 350 for about 40 minutes or until a knife comes out dry. Now, this made a large cake. It made a large cake, and it was really, like I said, really delicious. You can put either a cashew cream frosting on it, a vanilla cashew cream frosting, or if you do eat dairy, you can make a cream cheese frosting, and I will share the frosting recipe with you next week. Okay, so now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Earl Fultz. He is the CEO and founder of Harissa, which is a small artisanal food company on the North Fork of Long Island. And since he started, he's been getting so much attention, winning awards all over. He actually won the best startup, small startup company in the U.S. this year. His business is also a love story. It's a tribute to his late wife, and I'm going to really just let him tell us more about it. Earl, are you with us?
I am indeed. Yes, yes.
Well, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, happy to do so. I've been listening to you. Slow Food has got a lot of things going.
It does. I know where you live, Slow Food East End is very active. Our Slow Food chapter is also active. I don't know if as active, just because we don't have as many farms and great chefs as you do out on the East End in the North Fork, but we're working on it. We're working on it.
Good.
So,
I have to, right off the bat, I want to say that the product we have is Chorizo. It has a small C in front of the H, which I'll explain shortly.
But, okay. Chorizo. Okay. I assumed it was silent, but thank you. Yeah, when you see something in writing, you never know how it's really pronounced. And I know the actual spice from Morocco is called harissa.
Yeah, well, so, that's sort of a cousin, but a cousin. But my wife changed it to fit to American tastes and American children, American husband, etc.
Uh huh. Well, why don't you share first with everyone listening what is harissa, and then what is the difference between what your wife came up with, chorizo? What is the difference?
The difference is that harissa, and I know this is the way I pronounce it, if there's a lot of different ways, harissa is hot. It'll take your head off, the original. And it's, you know, it fits into the Moroccan cuisine, which I consider one of the best in the world. It has its place, but it's very narrow in its application because it's all jalapeno and tomato. What my wife did was throw out the jalapeno because a hot sauce is a hot sauce, whatever. You know, there's about dozens of them on the market. And now all they do is be hot. What she wanted was something that reflected Moroccan tastes without having to spend 3-4 hours doing a tagine or a couscous or a mishri or all the other great foods of Moroccan cuisine, but we, you know, America, we're busy. So she was able to come up with a spice that is, all you really need to do is you can cook with it, but you don't have to. And if you don't want to, you can take your own favorite recipe and put a spoon or two or a couple of shakes of chorizo on your. Oops, something's interrupting. We'll get
no, if, back. We're doing a radio interview.
Oops.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, I got interrupted there. Let me just say that you can cook with it, but you don't have to because it you can use it as an ingredient. The chefs do. We sell it in the large sizes, but if you just want to put it on a sandwich or a meatloaf, you make a couple of spoonfuls and you have a whole different taste. And the main thing that she did was take out the jalapeno and put in cumin and Spanish paprika. And that made all the difference.
Uh-huh.
She didn't set out to do this, but it's a seasoning that is good on everything.
And
truly, I was at a restaurant show, and I said it was good on everything but ice cream, and the guy next door was selling ice cream. And he said, try it on chocolate. And we did. And you can put chorizo on chocolate ice cream and have a whole different flavor.
And
it's
wow.
Marvelous. It's a marvelous, marvelously flexible, and the real thing about it, and I want to emphasize, and I owe a lot of this to Jerry Woodhouse, who's now my partner, but helped me get chorizo off the ground. It's healthy, and cumin is the healthiest spice of all. We can't put that on the label, but cumin is a healthy spice. It's a little expensive, but it's healthy.
Right, it has a lot of medicinal value to it.
Yes, everything in chorizo is natural and healthy. Even we use organic olive oil and lemon juice to make the condiment. I mean, the dry rub and the condiment have the same spices, so they're interchangeable also.
Uh-huh. So what's the difference between the dry rub and the spice? Is it just the olive oil?
The difference between the dry rub and the condiment is that we add the lemon juice and olive oil to the dry spice.
Uh-huh.
So anybody can do it, actually.
Right.
A little secret.
Uh-huh. Now, your label
I'm sorry
says
to be
authentic.
Running on like this. It's your show. Ask me a question.
Uh-huh. Your label says authentic on it, but it's actually produced here. And it's different than harissa. So what makes it authentic? Just that it's natural?
No, here's a little footwork on my part. I decided that authentic in Morocco, in fact, with any ethnic food is whatever your grandmother or your Aunt Sophie or whoever says it is. I mean, that's the tradition of ethnic foods in this country. The authenticity comes from those who are doing the cooking. And my wife's family, her mother particularly, was a super cook, and my wife was, I think, her equal. My mother-in-law was a big favorite of Craig Claiborne's at one time. He thought that she did marvelous stuff, and I think other people have been influenced by her cooking.
Uh-huh.
So authentic to me is whatever your grandmother says it is.
Right. There you go. I agree with you.
Don't argue with your grandmother. Don't argue with me.
Right. Authentic, as long as it's from many generations ago, so that it can be authentic.
Yes. It wasn't
authentic
made in a
my
laboratory
mother
like so much of the food today. You know, they're sneaking the sugar and this came out of tradition, not out of a laboratory. It makes a difference.
Right. Right. Now, you said your wife, Gloria, was from Morocco.
Yes.
But you're not from Morocco, right? You grew up on a farm in Montana.
That's true, yes. I cannot deny it.
So how did you guys meet? How did you find each other?
Well, is this an hour-long show?
The short version.
Well, very quickly, one thing I've said there was there's a Moroccan word mektub, mektub, which means it is written. So they say, how you get together? I said, it had to happen.
Uh-huh.
But that's an Arab word, and my wife comes from a long line of Sephardics that we're thinking to go back to the Phoenicians, but it's lost dim in history. But excuse me. It was the World War II that did it. Her father, once France fell, was certain the Nazis were going to invade North Africa, and so he picked up the whole family and brought them to America. He was in the almond business, and he had, you know, contacts around with the Hershey's and Cadbury's and all that sort of thing. I was in college when the war came, and we ended up in the AF. And after the war, with the GI Bill, instead of going back to the University of Montana, which is a fine school, but you know, not what I wanted, I decided to come to New York and go to Columbia. And ultimately, after Columbia was very good, I was in a writing class with Paul Gallico, who was a big writer at the time. I got married to a daughter of a Brooklyn doctor who had worked on what's now the New York Post. And she had an agent, and I got an agent because I started selling once I got out of school, out of college. And the agent was my wife, Gloria's aunt. It gets complicated.
Uh-huh.
She was married. I was married. 12 years later, 14, we got married to one another, and it went lasted for 50 glorious years.
Yeah, so you were a writer in your earlier life?
Yes, most of my life, one way or another. But usually I get back to writing as the way I make a living, I mean, even with Charissa writing about it, talking about it, thinking of, you know, how to sum up in a couple of words that it's healthy, that it's natural, that it's good on everything. It's still writing of a sort. It's I should say I'm not as nimble as I once was, for reasons we'll go into shortly.
Well, Earl, most people, you know, most people that are still here on the planet at 92 are thinking about retiring, and yet you somehow are first starting up a startup company that's taking off. Where do you get your energy from?
Well, I have to tell you, growing up on a farm in back 92 years ago was good. I mean, my mother could have qualified as a founding member of Slow Food, I think, because she was a real nut about food, about eating right, and being healthy. There were doctors, we rarely saw a doctor because they were, you know, some distance away. We were quite a few miles from the nearest town, and doctors didn't do much. You know, they didn't have penicillin, or they didn't have any of the medicines we have now. So she was very careful about what we ate, and we grew our own food. We had a huge truck farm of at least 2.5-3 acres. We sold it to other people. It was one of the ways we got through the Depression. But see, we canned our own food. We butchered our own animals. I was telling my partner Jerry Woodhouse about the importance of the root cellar in Montana, where 40 below weather was not uncommon in the wintertime, because we lived only 35 miles from the Canadian border and we got all their weather. I wish they could send it back to them. The root cellar was the way we kept some semblance of fresh food into the winter, and there was, we would put everything down there. We even green tomatoes. It was freezing by the end of September out there, and green tomatoes we would put in the root cellar. They would ripen and last maybe 3-4 weeks into November. We knew that the cabbages could make it into December, maybe a little later, you know, peel off the outer things. The root vegetables, the parsnips and the carrots would last until February. We had to, you know, brush off the roots that would grow on them. And of course, potatoes lasted all year long. But the thing I wanted to say was, with my mother and fresh foods, the instant the dandelions showing up, they weren't, you know, to people who have lawns, dandelions are an annoyance. To us, they were a lifesaver. We were out there digging up and eating dandelion like crazy, because we were desperate for fresh green stuff. We never bought anything from the store except spices and salmon. Salmon we used to buy 10 cents a can. I remember that. But everything else, we lived totally off the farm. We canned hundreds of jars of stuff in a year. We were the whole family get together and, you know, make corn or make tomatoes. We made our own tomato juice, our own tomato sauce. It was post frontier, which can be summed up very quickly by make it, make do, or do without. That was the early years of my life. Truly, we didn't have. We farmed with horses. We had a carbon footprint like the Indians, I would say, who were still nearby. Sorry, I'm going on too long. I'm not.
No, that's okay. That's okay. You know, it's wonderful to hear, because we don't get to hear from many people that grew up like that. And, you know, as someone who grew up in the suburbs on Long Island, I would like to see more and more people get back to that, if not to that extreme. You know, certainly growing more and more of our own fresh fruits and vegetables. You know, we call it homesteading now. And, you know, I try to live that way myself. And, you know, I have lots of fruit trees that I'm growing fruit, and I have a garden. I try to do my canning. So I give it a try. I wouldn't say I'm successful. I still spend hundreds of dollars all the time at the health food store, but, you know, I think it's the trend, and I think it's the way that we really need to start going if we really want to help the survival of our planet. So,
we have huge problems there. One of them being water. I don't want to diverge from our main story too much, but I grew up in a valley in Montana that was irrigated by a river, the Elk River, that started in Glacier Park. Glacier Park at one time had 165 glaciers. It is now down to 4, and they will be gone in 2 or 3 more years.
Oh, no. Really?
And glaciers are the source of water for many rivers. You know, all the rivers that glaciers are half gone. I have no idea how we're going to solve the water problem because it's going to be different. I mean, that's environmental stuff, and I don't want to get in on that one. Let me get back to my wife. She was a great cook. I was a great eater. That's one solution to my mother was a great cook in her way. I followed the food, I guess.
I wanted to actually take a couple of minute break, and when we come back, I want to invite your VP of sales, Jerry Woodhouse, who I believe is there with you, and
yes,
is also the founder of a company called The Taste of the North Fork, and invite her on to also tell us a little bit about what she's doing and how you guys connected.
Right.
So everyone listening, don't go anywhere.
Yes, we're all listening, and yes, she's essential to the operation, very much so.
Great.
Yes.
Well, we'll be right back. We're going to take just a couple of minute break. Everyone listening, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Thanks.
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
The mind is the brain.
The mind is a garden we tend.
The mind is a hive of memes.
The mind is a monkey who needs to chill.
The mind is a magic deck.
The mind is a web, and you are a spider.
Looking for in-depth conversations about mysticism and mind science?
Technology and visionary experience?
Religion and uncanny culture?
Tune in to Expanding Minds.
With Eric Davis.
And Maja Daou.
On the Progressive Radio Network.
Or download us on iTunes.
And remember, keep your mind open.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today and who I'm talking with is Earl Fultz. He's the CEO of Teresa, a wonderful startup, a delicious spice, and he has with him Jerry Woodhouse, who is the founder of A Taste of the North Fork, and she is now the vice president of this small, wonderful startup company. And
and we're going to talk to her as well. Hello, Earl and Jerry. You there?
We are. Good morning, Bhavani.
Hi-ho.
Good morning. Good morning. So, Jerry, I was wondering if you could share with us how you came about discovering Earl, or if Earl found you. How did that partnership
come? Okay, well, I have a commercial kitchen out at the east end of Long Island, and I make food products for a number of the farms, farmers, farm stands, some restaurants, and occasionally some chefs. And a couple of 2 years ago, I got a phone call from a man who I didn't know him at the time, who said, I'm looking to talk to somebody about food, and the local printer recommended your name. Could I come in and meet with you? And I said, certainly, come on in. He walked in the door. I had never met him before, didn't know anything about him. This tall, attractive old man walks in, puts out his hand and says, hi, I'm Earl. I'm 88 years old and I want to start a food business. Can you help me? That was his opening line. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. I said, well, what would you like to do? And he said, well, my wife, who is Moroccan, created this family recipe. We've had it in our family for many years. Everybody's always been encouraging us to do something with it, to produce it, and the time is right, and I want to know if you can help me. So I said, okay, sit down, let's talk about what is this product. And he said, well, it's called Charissa. And I said, Harissa? He said, no, this is Charissa with a C. I said, well, what is it? And he said, well, it's a Moroccan seasoning that's good on everything. Now, I have to say, lots of people think that their product is wonderful and good on everything, so I was a bit skeptical and said, okay. And I said, well, tell me more about it. And with that, he opened up a suitcase that was filled with all kinds of crackers and cheese and whatever, and a jar of this particular product. And he said, the only way you're going to know what Charissa is if you taste it, Jerry. So I sat there and put some on a cracker and ate it and thought, well, I've never had anything that tastes just like this before. That was my first thought. And as we talked, I found myself dipping into it, trying more and more and more. And before the afternoon and our conversation had concluded, I had tried it on cheese, on eggs, on anything that he had brought for me. And I found that it was captivating because no matter what I put it on, it tasted good, but it tasted very different. So that just led to me saying, okay, let's see if I can produce it the way you want. One thing led to another. Earl started this company. Originally it was called something else. We got to the point where it was in a jar that other people could taste it. We developed a label for it. And because I was doing farmers markets, brought the product to a farmers market to see what the reception would be. People came by and they tried it. Earl was a great salesman and got people to, you know, experiment and see what this product was all about. And within 2 or 3 weeks, he was selling more of his Charissa at the booth than I was selling anything that I was making. And he turned to me and said, I need my own booth. I can't share it with you anymore. I need to rent a table, which he did. And lo and behold, within a short period of time, it was not uncommon for him to be selling $500 worth of these small jars of Charissa at every farmer's market. And that's how it started.
It had legs.
It did. I had an opportunity to go to a food and wine show in the city, and so I invited Earl to come with me. I was exhibiting there. Same story. This time we served Charissa on meatballs. It was very easy to just, you know, put the skillet on, have the meatballs, put the sauce on, and anybody coming by could try it on a toothpick. And as we were busily handing out all these meatballs on a stick, a very tall man, I just remember to this day seeing him because he was quite tall, reached over, speared a meatball, ate it, stepped back, didn't change his expression, but stood there with his arms crossed for a few minutes, reached over, threw his card down on the table and said, call me. That night when we looked at all the leads and the cards that we had, his card was from the executive chef at Yankee Stadium. Legends Hospitality runs the food concessions. He was the executive chef. One thing led to another, and without, much longer, our first really big order came in from Yankee Stadium. So Earl's wife, who had been ill at the time, she was still here to enjoy the fact that somebody who we considered a really great, promising chef tasted this product that we were trying to introduce to the world and said he loved it and had to have it. So it was one of the highlights of the start of our company, and from there on, it's just grown and grown. We partnered because being 92, it's not as easy for Earl to get out and do some of the sales and marketing as it is for me, but he is, to this day, he, as you can tell, I think from listening to him, he's the inspiration behind everything we do. Every single day, it's challenging and interesting because he keeps me on my toes.
That's a great story.
And you're not a ballet dancer.
I'm not a ballet dancer, no. And, of course, now Charissa is, you mentioned that it won a number of awards. It did Wells Fargo. That was a tremendous success in the very first year to be named Best New Startup, the only one in the food industry that they recognized that year. We went on to be acclaimed by Bon Appetit magazine as a Best New Product of the Year in beginning of 2015. And then last summer, we submitted Charissa for a Sophie Award at the Fancy Food Show in New York, and we won in our category. So it has gotten a number of reviews that have been so positive, and now we are shipping Charissa to people in their homes all across the country.
Wow.
There's food innovation.
That's a great story.
Yes, yes. We have a distributor out of Florida who sells just to chefs online. And with that company, Charissa is in 48 states right now.
That's amazing. In just 4 years?
Actually 2.5 years from the time I started manufacturing it for Earl, yes.
Uh-huh. That is really amazing. Now, Earl, what was your inspiration in actually taking it to this step? What really motivated you to, like I said, you know, at your age, you know, usually people are thinking about wanting to slow down and retire. What inspired you to take something on so big and so full time?
Okay, I'm going to talk for just a second. It's hard for Earl. But when his wife was diagnosed with emphysema and given 5 years to live, he took care of her. She didn't go into a nursing home, and she lived 4 years. And in the last year, she said to Earl, "You need something to do when I'm no longer here." And she's the one who urged him to start this company, this business, because she thought that what would he do with himself? They had spent, you know, their whole 50-something years of life together. Here he would be living in a retirement community by himself. What was he going to do? So she's the one who really pushed him. And as you can hear, even today, to talk about it, it's difficult.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, a lot of times, what's the saying? You know, you look at a strong man or a powerful man and there's a powerful woman behind him, you know? You know, it's beautiful when you see that and you see the inspiration that someone gets from another person. It's really nice.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that certainly motivates me and inspires me every day is that there's such a love story between Earl and Gloria that's reflected in the fact that he started this company. But when you think back, when Earl talks about his mother and what she did, her whole motivation was she loved her kids, she cared about her kids, she wanted them to eat the healthiest they could. Gloria also, she took this recipe, which came from an old family recipe, a harissa, which was really hot, and for her American children, she wanted something that not only tasted better for them, that was more acceptable for their palate, but something that would be really good for them. And the fact that the product has, you know, no sugar, no gluten, no MSG, it's just healthy spices, olive oil and lemon juice, is really a tribute that comes out of their both of the women and Earl and their love for their children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm back. Yes, it was. It started out just to see, you know, what as a kind of a hobby, and on the very first week that I exhibited on my own, Erica Marcus, a food writer from Newsday, came, tasted, and said, and started writing about it. She flipped for it also. Hence our little slogan, if you try it, you're going to buy it, so be careful. And she was the one that coined the phrase, it's addictive, which we which we use. It is.
Well, it is. When I saw you, Jerry, last week, you gave me a little jar of it.
And, of course, I broke it open, too, right away, and everybody loved it. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a great
thing.
Let me
tell you, it's not really addictive. What it is that if you have Charissa on something that is ordinarily kind of dull, you know, potatoes or macaroni or something that isn't seasoned well, and even if it is seasoned well, but if you have it on that, then the next thing you eat seems boring. You want to go back to that extra change that Charissa brings to ordinary food. If that's addictive, then maybe we can call it addictive. But
Earl, I wanted to say it's addictive in a physiological way also. One of the principles of cumin, as I understand it, is that because it is so good for your body and your body appreciates it, the body wants more. So the more you eat something that is good for you, the more your body wants you to eat, and that's where the addiction for a lot of foods come from. Of course, it also works in a bad way, too, if you become addicted to sugar and other kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
But in this particular case, I think it's primarily the cumin, and the product has both cumin and cumin seed in it.
I truly wish I were younger because it's a big education job for us and for America. As we looked into what kids are addicts, sugar addicts. By the time they're 6 or 7, they get everything thrown at them is sugar. And I used to think that Warren Buffett was a great man because he could make money out like no one else. Part of his fortune, and the big part, was sugar. He was deeply involved with Coca-Cola all these years, and he had a candy company and this and that. And then not long ago, he spent $22 billion buying the biggest ketchup company in the world. And I'm saying, it's nice for people to be successful in business, but if it's going to be from getting our children addicted to sugar by the time they're 6 or 7, then we have to start fighting it. And
right.
We're doing it in our own way because kids really like Charissa. They'll eat their spinach with it. I can prove it.
Uh-huh. Well, it's true. You want to do something that is in alignment with your morality, your ethics, and you don't want to produce something that is bad for people. And I always wonder how people, do that who work for, companies that are putting out products that are doing bad to the world, How can they go to sleep every night and feel okay about themselves?
Be honest, with us taking on Mr. Buffett and his sugar makes the David and Goliath thing not even adequate. We're so small and they're so big, but we're making noise, and we're glad to be talking I was talking to you because we're pushing in our own little way, and I think we're making progress.
Well, you really are. I think you just recently did you go into a new facility or you bought new equipment so that you can really produce this at the rate that you need to?
Yes, and my mother lived to 100 years, and I am determined to live longer than she did.
So you can see the success of this business.
Well,
but Jerry, did you just
try.
Expand your kitchen?
We're collecting people who really believe in the product, and they are helping us enormously to move out of the artisanal into the it's a tough market out there. I mean, the supermarkets they have a lot of people, a lot of companies with money. The fight for shelf space is fierce.
But to get back to your question, we have just recently invested in some new equipment. So filling machines, cappers, and labelers are being installed as we speak, and that'll help us increase our production and keep our costs under control.
Right, that's what
we
I was thinking.
We can do a pallet a day easily
at
now.
At a certain point, I'm sorry, go ahead, Errol.
I was just going to say we can do a pallet a day easily now, which is 3,000 jars, and if necessary, we could push it to 2 pallets a day, which is a pretty big output for us. To do 6,000 jars a day, but we have.
So once you're doing 6,000 jars, are you still artisanal? what point?
We are, because the equipment we bought is semi-automatic, There's nothing where you are not directly involved with every step of the product and the actual manufacturing of it, making it before it goes into the hopper to be filled is still small, hands-on, one blender at a time, if you will.
Oh, that's great. Because, yeah, that's what made it great. And you want to be careful, right, not to grow too fast and lose what's special about it.
So we keep doing it by hand until the point where it actually goes in the bottle, has to be capped and labeled, and that's just sped up by the mechanics of the equipment we purchased.
Mm-hmm.
And
does all that fit into your place, Jerry?
Too, so it'll make it easy for people to sample it without opening a jar. So we really think that 2016 is going to be a most interesting year.
What do you anticipate as the future of Teresa?
Well, I, being in my manic phases, which is fairly frequently, I truly think that given a little time, it will take on every other sauce, condiment, and whatnot is out there. I think we could be number one in a few years. I really do. Because nothing else is quite like we are. We're good on everything. We're flexible. You can use it as a dry rub, as a condiment, or as an ingredient. I think it has a great future.
Yeah, look at Sriracha, right? I think Sriracha is now outpaced ketchup. And, a few years back, no one even heard of Sriracha sauce.
Right. It took them 30 years. I don't have 30 years.
But what we want to do is really get the word out there that unlike a lot of the other products that we've named without being very specific, there's no corn syrup, there's no high fructose corn syrup, there's no sugar, there's no additives, there's no preservatives. Everything that comes out of a Teresa jar is 100% natural.
Yeah,
and only good ingredients. You know, we buy the best, even though it costs more. We want it to be right.
You buy organic olive oil too, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And sea salt.
Uh huh.
We minimize sodium as much as possible, and I do believe that if people who want to avoid salt, we're a good way to do it because we use as little salt as possible, and you don't miss the salt with Teresa. At least I don't. And I put it in everything, of course. I would
agree with you. I tasted it, and it was not very salty. And I do actually love salt, but it was not very salty, and I did not need to add any. It was really perfect, just the way
so
it was.
Just imagine if in all of our schools where kids eat French fries and hamburgers all day long, all week long in every school, they had Teresa instead of a ketchup or anything else that's adding additional sugar in their lives.
Right.
It'd be a terrific thing. So, yes, we have big visions of what we'd like to do. We'd like to change the eating habits of all the kids that we come in contact with. And bit by bit, we're seeing it happen.
Especially I heard a horror story about a school that tried to get kids to eat healthy, and because it wasn't sweet, they were chucking it into the garbage. And I know that Teresa can make them want to eat it because at the farmers markets and other places, if I see a mother coming with a child anywhere between 6 and 15 or 16, I say let him try it or her try it, the meatball first, and you decide whether it's tasty or not. And the kids invariably like Teresa. I mean, it's quite amazing. And that's what gives us hope that if we just get it into the right channels, we can affect what kids do.
And is it just the one product? I mean, I know you have the rub and the product with the olive oil and lemon, but do you have different flavors?
And it's made in two heats. I mean, it's the original flavor, and then it's with a kick, which has more cayenne in it. We're just manufacturing one product. Of course, we do some other other things as well. We make preserved lemons, but that's not our main focus. And the other thing is that when we won the award for the best condiment seasoning, it also included the fact that it was used as an ingredient. So we find that several businesses are incorporating Charissa in, for example, pickles. There is a pickle maker right near us who makes a carrot cauliflower pickle and adds Charissa to the base. We have somebody who is making chocolate fudge and has added some of the Charissa powder to the fudge, and it gives it a fabulous flavor. There are salad dressings that are incorporating it, people who are making popcorn and using the spice rub with the popcorn. There's lots and lots of ways that we think that Charissa can be used without us having to create whole line extension at this point in time. And as Earl said, together between us, we don't have that many years to keep spitting out more and more products. We just want to focus on this one.
Well, that's nice. I'm so happy for you that you found a product that you also just are, you know, thrilled about and can really focus on.
Thank you.
You've had your company for a while. How long has the Taste of the North Fork been around?
About 12 years.
So, yep.
And I've made a lot of products. I make some great products for people. This one is truly unique.
Well, and Jerry's a legend out here, I must say, and I'm stealing her away from other people. without her, Charissa would not be where it is. She's been incredibly important, and we're a fairly pretty good team. And we have real hopes for the future. We really do.
Great. Well, before we run out of time, can you share for my listeners where they can either purchase it or your online website, or how can they find you?
Sure. Well, our online website is charissaspice.com. Very simple. Charissa with a C, C-H-A-R-I-S-S-A, spice.com. Our local phone number is 631-734-8877. We are in many of the small stores around. We're in IGA at the east end of Long Island. In Manhattan, it's Calustian Spices, Sahadi in Brooklyn. The best thing is to go online and check out, or give us a call, and we'll tell you where in your neighborhood you could find us.
And you can ship it as well?
Oh, yes. We ship every single day. Yep.
Wonderful.
We're happy to ship.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. Earl, I look forward to meeting you in person.
Okay, anytime. Come on out.
Always a pleasure.
To the North Fork, we're becoming quite a center of fresh and good and local grown and unique. And you're going to hear more about us on the North Fork, the pickles and the bread and the Charissa, of course, and private label things. We're sort of all getting together and saying, to quote Ben Franklin, I think it was hang together or you hang separately. So we're going to be hanging together more and more as in the future.
There you go. That's great. Well, everyone out there for joining us, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.